If you have your Bible, I hope you do, turn to Colossians chapter 1, and in your pew Bible, in front of you, it's page 1017, if you're looking for it, there, Colossians chapter 1. I want to ask a question this morning. So you heard the story of Jesus coming into Jerusalem on Palm Sunday on a donkey. And the mixed reactions of people that we'll find out as we continue through Holy Week, how they responded to Jesus. But who really was this person on this donkey? And to help us understand this, I want you to picture this. Imagine a photo of someone you love. Maybe it's a photo that's on your phone, or maybe it's a photo that's on your mantle or a shelf in your house. You keep it somewhere where you can see it. And then someone starts stacking other photos on top of it. Now, this is a photo of a loved one, a dear one, a spouse or a mother or father or somebody very dear, close to you. And these other photos that start getting stacked on top of it, nice photos, nothing wrong with any of them, but one by one, they pile up until you can't see the face that matters the most. Nobody took your photo. It's still there at the bottom. They just buried it. And by doing that, they hid the value of the worth of that picture. And that's what's starting to happen to the church in Colossae. Paul in chapter 1, 1 through 8 is saying, we heard that you heard. We heard that you heard the gospel, not by us, because Paul says, I'm in prison, but by one of our disciples, Epaphras. He brought the gospel to his own people back in Colossae, and God birthed the church there through the gospel, and fruit was starting to grow, and they were strengthened by the hope that was going to be revealed in heaven for them. And then in verses 9 through 14, he had prayed for them. But what was starting to happen was things were starting to erode this church in Colossae. New teachers had arrived with a big, impressive spiritual package. Well, here's what you really need to get clued in. You need angel worship, secret knowledge, special rituals, a whole chain of cosmic beings you have to navigate to help get closer to God. And the message underneath all that was, Jesus got you started, but you need more than that. And Paul's answer is not an argument. It's a picture. He says, let me show you exactly who Jesus is. Because Paul knows something about Jesus. If you see him clearly, you'll know that nothing is missing. And you don't need to move on from him. You move in to be filled with his fullness. And so Paul will start in verses 15 through 23 with a whole universe. And he'll narrow all the way down to you and me. And there's three movements in this passage. Jesus is Lord over everything. Jesus, therefore, is Lord over the church. And therefore, Jesus is enough for you. And so earlier, in verses 9 through 14, before our passage today, Paul and Timothy had rejoiced that they had heard that the Colossians had heard through Epaphras and received Jesus, and Paul had prayed for a mind that was saturated with truth, filled with the fullness of the desire of God for them in this letter. And then he had prayed for a walk that is saturated with worthiness, worth. And then he had prayed for a heart that's saturated with power in verse 11. And then he had prayed for a soul that's saturated with the mercy and grace of God. And now we come to verse 15. So let me read verses 15 through 23. Colossians chapter 1. Who is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn of every creature? For by him were all things created that are in heaven and that are on earth, visible and invisible. Whether they be thrones or dominions or principalities or powers, all things were created by him and for him. And he is before all things, and by him all things consist. And he is the head of the body, the church, who is the beginning, the firstborn from the dead, that in all things he might have the preeminence. For it pleased the Father that in him should all fullness dwell. And having made peace through the blood of his cross, by him to reconcile all things unto himself, By him I say, whether they be things in earth or things in heaven, and you that were sometime alienated and enemies in your mind by wicked works, yet now hath he reconciled in the body of his flesh through death to present you unholy and unblameable and unreprovable in his sight, if you continue in the faith, grounded and settled, and be not moved away from the hope of the gospel, which ye have heard, and which is preached to every creature which is under heaven, whereof I, Paul, am made a minister. First thing I want you to see in verses 15 through 17 is that Jesus is Lord over creation. He is Lord over all that has been made. And he shows us what God is like. The verse says he's the image of the invisible God. A God is a spirit, invisible, infinite, beyond us. So how do we know what God's like? He sent his son. And the word image that Paul uses means an exact copy, an icon, not a sketch, not a symbol, the real thing, but in human flesh that you and I could see. When you look at how Jesus treated people, because obviously you and I can't see Jesus, he was crucified, resurrected, and he's ascended at the right hand of the throne of God. But you know where you can see Jesus? You can see Jesus in the story of his life, the Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. And when you see how Jesus treated people, the ones he touched, the ones he defended, the ones he forgave, the ones he confronted, you are seeing how God treats people. Jesus said it himself, whoever has seen me has seen the Father. So Jesus is Lord of creation because Jesus shows us what God is like. Secondly, he owns everything that exists. He's Lord of creation because he owns everything that exists. It says he's the firstborn of all creation. The cults read that, and they twist it to say that Jesus was the first thing God created. That's not what it means. In the Bible, firstborn was the title of rank, not age. It meant the most important, the heir of everything. God called Israel his firstborn, even though Israel, obviously, in history, wasn't the oldest nation. But it means it's a supreme honor. And Paul immediately tells us why Jesus gets that title. Look in verse 16. Why does he get that title? For by him were all things created that are in heaven and on earth. So Jesus is not the first thing God made. He is the eternal God, the one God used to make everything. Think about it like a contractor. A contractor who builds a house doesn't belong to the house. He owns it. Jesus didn't come out of the universe. He built it. So Jesus is Lord over creation because he shows us what God is like. He owns everything that exists. And then also, Jesus made, therefore, every spiritual power that exists. So what do you mean? I mean spiritual powers, beings that you and I can't see, including the ones people fear. Right in the middle of verse 16, Paul adds a list that we may tend to skip over. And he says, the things that you can see and the things that you can't see. And you could read, such as thrones or dominions or rulers or authorities. Now, you could read that easily and think Paul's talking about kings and governments. But that's not the thing Paul has in mind here. He's using words that refer to unseen spiritual beings and their ranks in the unseen realm. To understand this, you have to think about how people in Paul's world thought about the invisible world. In the ancient world and all throughout the Old Testament, people understood, and we should as well, that the physical world we can see is not the only world that exists. We don't only live by our five senses. There is also an invisible world filled right now with real spiritual beings. The Bible calls them by different names. Some of them refer to the things they do. Some refers to their ranks. But angels, spiritual rulers, heavenly beings, the sons of God, these beings are real. They have real power. And in Paul's day, and in the Colossian false teaching, and also today, and other religions and many new age ideas, people thought you have to deal with these beings carefully by getting on their good side. You might need to worship some of them or go through them to get to God. Deuteronomy says that when God scattered the rebellious nations at Babel, he turned them over to rebellious supernatural beings to be in charge of different people groups, nations. And these rogue spiritual beings, rebellious angels, demanded worship for themselves, and they become, throughout the Old Testament scriptures, the false gods or the spiritual powers working against God's purposes. And that's obviously why Paul will remind the Ephesians in chapter 6, finally, my brethren, be strong in the Lord and in the power of his might. Put on the whole armor of God. Why? That you may be able to stand against the wiles of the devil. Well, how are those wiles, those trickeries, those cunning things revealed? He says, for we do not wrestle against flesh and blood. We don't wrestle against what you can see with your five senses. We wrestle against principalities, against powers, against the rulers of the darkness of this age, against spiritual hosts of wickedness in the heavenly places. Therefore, take up the whole armor of God so that you may be able to withstand in the evil day, and having done all, to stand. And so that's the background of what the false teachers in Colossae were peddling. They were saying these spiritual powers are real, and that's correct. They're powerful. That's correct. And you need to work with them. That's incorrect. Honor them. Connect with them. Follow certain rules to stay on their good side. Give them submission or offerings so that then they'll have their power behind you and you can have good luck and their blessing. And really what they're saying is it's not enough just to have Jesus. You need to navigate this whole invisible chain of command above you. And so Paul's answer in verse 16 is a very radical sentence in the Bible. All of these powers, every throne, no matter what name you want to give them, every dominion, every ruler, every authority in the invisible world, created by who? And ultimately, for who? Jesus. So let me let that sink in a little bit. The spiritual beings, the false teachers said you needed to fear and court and navigate. These manipulative ones, I'm not talking about the good angels who are on the Lord's side, but the ones who revolted here. They're creatures. Jesus made them. They exist because he spoke them into being. They were supposed to exist for him. And one day they will answer to him and answer how they did not serve his purposes. And they will answer to his authority, not the other way around. The chain of command does not go up through them to Jesus. It goes from Jesus down through. Someone put it this way. Paul isn't saying that these powers don't exist. He's saying they are creation, not creator. They are part of what Jesus built. And you don't pray to the furniture in a house to get to the owner. You go straight to the owner. And if you jump ahead one more chapter and cheat a little bit in Colossians 2:15, you know what Paul tells us? What happened to these powers at the cross? He says Jesus disarmed the rulers and authorities and put them to open shame by triumphing over them. So the cross wasn't just about forgiving individual sin. It did. But it was also a cosmic moment. Jesus went to the cross and the spiritual powers, the prince of the power of the air, the spirit that now works in the children of disobedience. Jesus went to the cross and those spiritual powers that had been holding humanity in bondage, demanding worship, driving fear, enslaving nations at the cross were stripped of their weapons. They're like a defeated enemy that is still making noise but has already lost the war. And this means something more practical than you might think for your life right now. If you're afraid of what feels like dark spiritual forces, powers that you can't see, evil that feels bigger than you, hear this. Those powers are real. And they are, to a certain point, fearful and foreboding. But every single one of those powers was made by Jesus and is under his feet. You don't have to go around Jesus to deal with them and face them face to face. You come inside Jesus. You go to Jesus, and they have to answer to him, and he gives deliverance from oppression and bondage. That's the Jesus who's coming into Jerusalem that day. He's coming into the devil's lair in Jerusalem. He's going to go pierce right to the heart of it at the temple, where the religious leaders representing the spiritual powers behind them have corrupted the temple and have pushed the Gentiles out of it and set up places where they're just transacting business instead of opening the temple to the nations. That's what's going on. And Jesus is breaking through that on that Palm Sunday, because he's going to send a gospel around the world. He holds everything together right now. Fourthly, he's Lord of everything because he holds everything together right now. Look what he says in verse 17, and he is before all things, and by him all things consist. They hold together. Paul's not just talking about the past. We know Jesus made that. He's talking about right now. Jesus is actively keeping the universe running. Your body is not flying apart right now into billions of atoms because Jesus is holding it together. Jesus is actively keeping it running. The reason physical laws are consistent, the reason the universe is ordered instead of chaos, is that Jesus is sustaining it. Think of like your phone signal. You probably don't struggle with this as much as I do in rural Maine, but in rural Maine, you can lose your phone signal a lot, depending if you go between a mountain or a valley and in the woods. But a phone signal, it's invisible. What if it cuts out? You notice it. You really notice it, right? And your phone's not connecting it, and like everything stops. Jesus is that for all of creation, except the signal never drops. The next time things may feel completely out of control, hear this. Jesus is right now holding the universe together right now, and your situation is part of that as well. So Jesus is Lord over all creation, but now he's going to shift to the new creation in verses 18 through 20. Jesus is Lord over the new creation. The new creation, I thought we didn't experience that. That's what we're waiting for. That's the hope we're going to see, right? When Jesus in Revelation 21 and 22, that new Jerusalem descends and God dwells on earth with men. That's the new creation. We're looking forward to that. New heavens and a new earth. Peter's looking forward to that in 2 Peter 3. But here is what he says about that in verse 18. And he is the head of the body, the church, who is the beginning, the firstborn from the dead, that in all things he might have the preeminence. For it pleased the Father that in him should all fullness dwell, and having made peace through the blood of his cross, by him to reconcile all things unto himself, by him, I say, whether they be things in earth or things in heaven. And you who are sometime alienated and enemies in your mind by wicked works, yet now hath he reconciled. How? In the body of his flesh, through death, to present you holy and unblameable and unreprovable in his sight, if you continue in the faith, grounded and settled, and be not moved away from the hope of the gospel, which you have heard, and which is preached to every creature which is under heaven, whereof I, Paul, am made a minister. He's the head and the firstborn from the dead, the head of the body of the church. The head and the body being the church, Jesus being the head, are not two separate things. If we walked in here today without heads, we would have a problem, right? Or if heads just appeared without bodies, we'd have an issue. Jesus is one with his church, the believers. The head and the body are not two separate things. They're one living system. The head directs the body. They correspond to each other. The church is not an organization that follows Jesus from a distance. It's a body with a living head, feeding it, running it, giving it life. And then do you notice the word that Paul uses again? It's the word firstborn. But this time, it's Jesus is the firstborn from the dead. Just like Jesus is first and greatest over everything that was created, He's now first and greatest over everyone who rises from the dead. His resurrection wasn't just a miracle for him. It was the first step of a whole new order of life. Everyone who belongs to Jesus will follow everywhere he went. And that includes through the resurrection. And this is why the church is the first fruits. It's the foretaste of a new creation, because God has put his spirit in you. And these bodies that are decaying, he's put his spirit in you as a taste of what will be new and fresh. We're the taste of a new creation. We're the taste of what God's goodness is to this world. That's what the church is. The fact that you're all here listening to some guy babble on from the Bible isn't just because this is what you do on Sunday. This is because we're new people. We receive the Spirit of God. We're adopted into his family. We're part of something that is cosmic, that is going on. Because where did this gospel first go? It went from the Mediterranean beyond. And look where we are now. And we're hearing it. And we're responding to it. And it's creating people in Jesus. Jesus is Lord over the new creation, the church. And everything God is lives in Jesus. And how did he bring this new family, this new first taste, foretaste of the new creation in? He made peace by the blood of his cross. Verse 19 says, "For it pleased the Father that in him should all fullness dwell." Well, why? Because he's supposed to have the preeminence in everything. And so in him, the false teacher system spread God's presence out across this ladder of spiritual beings. You'd work your way up. A little divine power here, a little there, and Jesus is one rung. And maybe you even have heard this term, the Christ consciousness. Or there's an experience of Jesus to a certain level. And, you know, he's just one of many masters. No. Jesus isn't one wrong. Paul takes that idea and he crushes it. The fullness, all of it, is not distributed. It lives in Jesus permanently, completely. You don't need to climb the ladder. If you know Jesus, you're standing where all of God is, and you're in him. And verse 20 tells us what this fullness is doing. It is making peace, reconciling all things, putting together what sin broke. The whole creation groans. And it's looking forward to the day when these bodies are resurrected to be in their fullness when Jesus returns. And God is in the process of restoring. And the way he does it is the most stunning part. God has inserted his power into this creation through the gospel of Jesus Christ. That's how this happens. Because through that, he delivers faith, hope, and love. A hope that is unseen, that will one day be realized, that we have to take by faith now. That all things will be made right, and we will be with Jesus. That's why we need faith in this life now. And because I understand that my resolution is not now, but my resolution is then, in the future, at the second coming of Jesus Christ, when he makes all things new. Because that's where my hope is, the hope that's reserved in heaven for you that Paul will talk about in verses 1 through 8. Therefore, I can love. I can give up myself for the sake of others. I can love at cost. Because my resolution isn't this world. Oh, sure, there's some things I'd like to do, but you know what? My bucket list isn't this world. If this world is your bucket list, you don't understand hope. You don't understand the new creation. Save some of that for the new creation. You have plenty of time, and it's going to be way better anyway. Jesus has made peace, reconciled through the blood of his cross, made peace by the blood of his cross. Think about that. After this enormous cosmic language about the universe, fullness, all creation, heaven and earth, Paul lands on something specific and painful in a little tiny place of real estate in the world. Blood, a cross. Not a theory, not a decree from a safe distance. The creator of the universe entered his own creation, went on the wood that he had created, that was hewn from a tree that he had made, took the punishment that we had earned and deserved, and died in blood. He made peace not the easy way. There was no easy way. He made peace the hardest way possible because it was the only way that would actually work. And so therefore, Paul will say, finally, that Jesus is enough for you in verse 21 to 23. He's been talking about the cosmos, the world, the universe, and now he says in verse 21, and you. Whoa, think about that. I mean, creation, this new thing he's doing, new creation, the church. And guess what? Human beings. Colossae wasn't a cool city. It was actually a has-been city. It was starting to deteriorate because the emperor had built a highway that diverted around it. And so now that all went to Laodicea, where all the rich bankers were. And, you know, it'd be like, you know, some forgotten, suburb of New York City that was now kind of pushed off the map, and everything now went to Wall Street and Laodicea. And Paul says, and you guys, and we're not talking about a mega church here. We're talking about people meeting in living rooms in a has-been city that's starting to deteriorate. Paul says, and you sitting right there, you that were at one time alienated and enemies in your mind by wicked works, yet now hath he reconciled. You who once were alienated, cut off, excluded, no longer on the list, hostile in mind, your thinking pointed away from God. Your life was built around you as the center. You didn't have to be taught that. It was wired in, and that's enough to be separated from God. That's the condition Paul is describing. That's where you were, and now he says, here's where you are now. He has now reconciled you in the body of his flesh by his death. Three phrases. He's piling up in his body of flesh by his death. That didn't happen in the realm of ideas and think tanks and you know, philosophers here. It happened in history on a real day, on real wood, with real nails, with real blood. The reconciliation cost God everything. And what do you get out of this? Here's where you are now. End of verse 22. God presents you holy and blameless and above reproach before him. Now, those are words, if you've read the Old Testament, you understand to be used for a perfect sacrifice. No defect, acceptable to God. Because of Jesus' death, when God looks at you, that's what God sees. Not your record or a huddled mass of all kinds of disorder. He sees his son's record, though, and it's given to you freely. Not with a wrinkled nose, but with a, put a coat on my son, put a ring on his finger. Out of mercy. There's an old story of a young soldier who was sentenced to death for desertion, who was in Napoleon's armies, France. And his mother got an audience with Napoleon and begged for mercy. And Napoleon said, he doesn't deserve mercy. He deserted my army. He deserves to be executed. She said, sir, if he deserved it, it wouldn't be mercy. And so Napoleon was so moved by that he let him go. And that's just a little picture of the gospel. God looked at you guilty as charged and said, you go free. But he didn't just do it to say you can go free. You can go free because the Son of God died in your place. You go free. So you're not sort of accepted. Was Jesus' death sort of good? Was it pretty good. No, you're fully accepted because it was a full payment, holy and blameless and above reproach. And so you, when you respond to Jesus in that way, are as well. So if he has said Jesus is enough for you because here's where you were, here's where you are now, now he's going to say, and here's what you must do. You do not move on from this. This is plan A. There's no plan B. There's no step one, and now go to step two. You try Jesus, do this. No, look what he says in verse 23. If you continue in the faith, grounded and settled, and be not moved away from the hope of the gospel which you've heard, and which is preached to every creature which is under heaven, whereof I, Paul, am made a minister. Continue in the faith, stable and steadfast, not shifting away. There's no upgrades here. Don't move, Paul says. The gospel is not a starting gate that you run through and then you leave behind. It's the whole ground your life stands on. And so let me ask three simple questions as we close. And I want you to think about them honestly. Is Jesus big enough in your mind? Not the Sunday piece of your mind right now, but Tuesday, Thursday, Saturday morning. The one who made the universe, holds it together, defeated every spiritual power of the cross. Is that who fills your mind when you think about him? That's the one who rode in on the donkey. Is Jesus not big enough in your mind? Second question. Do you actually believe that he's enough for your standing with God? Because a lot of us can live with this low hum of spiritual anxiety in the background. God's disappointed with me, not quite good enough, etc. And certainly there may be things in your life that you need to confess so that you're in right relationship with God. But let me tell you something. God doesn't sit there on this chair like this. Like, you know what he does? He puts his son before you and says, come to my son. Like Grant shared, I am the door. And if you're a believer, you keep going to that door. You keep coming in. You don't move on from that. Verse 22 says, right now in Jesus, God sees you as holy and blameless. Not after you improve. You can't clean yourself up for Jesus. You have to receive his washing. Your standing is based on his record, not yours, and you live from that. But then there's this third part of it. That's what Jesus does. But, you know, we have a responsibility, too. And this third part is what verse 23 says. Are you moving on or are you staying in him? If he's big enough that Colossians 1:15 through 20 says, and he's enough for your standing with God, where else are you going to go? Drifting doesn't feel dramatic, does it? We went over the Verrazano. There are some tankers and some freight ships out there anchored. And if they pulled up that anchor and I went over that bridge tomorrow, they wouldn't be in the same place. Water moves. Tides move. But they might not even have realized that if they did pull up the anchor, it would have been probably a slow drift. And drifting doesn't happen overnight. It's slow. It doesn't feel dramatic. It happens a little at a time. Oh, life's getting really busy. Or prayer feels pointless because I prayed and prayed and prayed about this. Or this shiny thing over here is really interesting right now, and that's getting my attention. And Paul says, be stable, be steadfast. Real faith keeps going. Keep going. You don't move on from Jesus. You keep moving into him. So I started with a photograph, a picture of a dear loved one that slowly started to be buried under other photographs that you put on top of that. Paul's words sweep away those other pictures to remind us what's at there, what's at the bottom, what we need to gaze on. Here's what you see when those other pictures are gone. You see Colossians 1:15 through 23, the exact image of God, the owner of everything that exists, the one holding the universe together right now, the one who walked out of the grave into a new kind of life, the place where all God's fullness lives, the one who made peace, not by a distance, not by decree, but by bleeding on a cross. And then it narrows all the way down to you. Once cut off, hostile, not deserving mercy, and he came anyway. He died anyway. And now, when you trust that, when you give your life to that, God looks at you and he sees his son. And he sees you as holy and blameless and above reproach. So don't bury that face, that picture. Don't let other things stack on top of it. Keep looking at him, because Jesus is Lord over everything, and he is enough.